Thank you so much for coming. Thanks specifically to Greater Level Peace and Justice, Professor Tilly and the Department of Regional Economics, and the radio station here in Lowell for inviting me here. Thanks also to Karthik for all the work that he's done. I mean, I think it's extremely difficult for somebody to carry on kind of work that he's done all alone. I've had the privilege of working on various issues for the last several years, but I must say that I've always had the fortune of having others around me when I do my work. And to Karthik, I can only say that you've shown enormous amount of courage and determination in doing what you've done. Two weeks ago, the number of people dead, the number of civilians dead in Iraq reached a figure of 100,000. Even as we gather here today, the last week or two has produced in excess of 1,200 civilian deaths in Fallujah itself. The U.S. war machine moves along, destroying anything that it finds in its way. And we live in times of great terror at state machineries that go wild. And what is worse, we have elected a person who at this moment has more blood on his hands than Slobodan Milosevic, the butcher of Belgrade. We live in violent times, and I wish we could at this moment, because of the concern that we feel for the people of Iraq, actually discuss that. But there is another round of violence that unfolded a couple of years ago, about which I wish to start speaking. And there are ways in which we need to tie up this culture of violence and why we tolerate it. And that's where I'll be headed towards the end of my talk. As Sri Ram mentioned, on the 27th of February 2002, a train, the Sabarmati Express, carrying passengers coming into Gujarat, was attacked outside of the Godhra railway station, and one coach in it, as six, was burnt down. Newspapers reported it promptly the next morning. It was a gruesome massacre. 58 people in the bogey, in the coach, were killed. Of the 58, a large number of those who were killed were probably volunteers for the militant right-wing Hindu nationalist movement who were returning back to Gujarat after doing volunteer work towards temple building exercises in the city of Ayodhya, a prehistory of which I won't go into unless it comes up in the question and answer session, the Babri Masjid, its demolition, the claim for a Ram temple, etc., etc. Following this gruesome act, when the papers reported it, the mob of Muslims had gathered outside the railway station and had set this bogey on fire. 58 people died with no chance of escape, is the news that we heard. The country was reeling under the shock of a gruesome attack of that nature. But the people who responded to that event with caring, with a sense of grief, did not stand a chance of recovering, because by the next evening, all hell broke loose. A planned and systematically executed pogrom unfolded over the next 3.5 months, which left in excess of 2,000 Muslims, minorities in India, dead, in excess of 100,000 people homeless, and the most gruesome forms of violence unleashed in, and what is most important and to note is that it happened with such systematic planning, with state complicity, that, you know, has been testified to numerous times. There is a commission of inquiry that is currently still sitting, inquiring about what happened post-Godhra. And, you know, the kind of testimonies that have come up from police officers, from other representatives. There was a minister of the BJP, the right-wing government that was ruling the state, who actually said that there was a meeting in the chief minister's house the night of the Godhra incident, and he was later killed. The facts on who killed him and how is still unknown. But there was such systematicity to the process of that massacre that it's extremely difficult to even convey the sense of that to you in a short talk. All we know is that every single independent documentation effort that's happened, whether it is the Independent Jurists Association that went there or the Human Rights Watch report, every single one of it has pointed to differing and differential levels of state complicity in the process. And it's unique because in India, there have been communal riots. There has been violence between majority communities and minority communities. We've always called it riots because one doesn't know. In the thickly populated streets, somebody throws a stone at somebody else. Somebody sets something else. Somebody sets off a small firecracker or a small bomb in some congested area, and it unfolds into a riot wherein communities confront each other. But as Sriram said, these calm down, the police move in, however inefficient, however corrupt, they move in, they bring it under some kind of semblance of control in a very, very short time. In the end, when the count of the dead comes through, it always in the past used to be, all right, you know, a handful of people of one community and handful of people of the other community, all mostly poor, got massacred and lie dead in their graves and their crematoriums. But Gujarat was different, just as 1984, the anti-Sikh riots was different. 1984, the anti-Sikh riots was the first time when the state got involved in massacring its own citizenry. It happened for a period of 11 days after the killing of Mrs. Gandhi. Congress goons went out on a rampage. State complicity in that at that stage came in the form of a couple of ministers who helped the rioters, gave out voter lists, etc., so that people were able to identify who lived where. In Gujarat in 2002, it was far, far worse. Transcripts of police control room recordings will show you that the police at least were claiming that they had been ordered to inaction. There's a famous line, we do not have orders to save you. Right? I mean, this is the level, and I think it's been, I don't know whether a film called Final Solution came onto campus here. It's a brilliant film. I'd advise everybody to see it. It's a fascinating documentation, fascinating, I mean, it's such a word to use, of how systematically the whole thing unfolded. And the gruesomeness of it, I mean, the gender violence of it was just amazing in terms of the fact that the number of Muslim women who were raped, and the ways in which the rapes were carried out, the ways in which, I mean, pregnant women's stomachs were torn, wombs were torn open, and babies were speared. In some places, as these genocidal massacres were unfolding, there were people following it with video cameras. So there was a voyeuristic element to this. I mean, it just gets more and more gruesome as we think about it. So this is the politics that unfolded. And behind it was a set of organizations that have been implicated many times over in communal violence. The chief organization behind all of this is an organization called the RSS, or the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is, to put it mildly, a neo-fascist organization. Born in 1924, modeled in some part specifically around how the Italian fascists modeled their organization. As a matter of fact, there are very well-documented historical texts of one of the mentors of the founder of the RSS going to Italy, meeting with Mussolini, coming back with testimonies of how the cell-like structures were organized, etc., etc. So this is the background of the RSS. It starts in 1924. Amongst the things that it does was it builds a militant Hindu movement, initially packaged as cultural revival, but clearly interested in the question of nationhood. And the claim is towards India being a Hindu nation. That equation of India equal to Hindu is what has been central to the existence of the RSS for several decades. The RSS saw a downward turn in its fortunes immediately after independence because somebody who was closely associated with the RSS, and some claim he was a member of the RSS, Nathuram Godse, was involved in the murder of Mahatma Gandhi. The RSS seemed to, but the investigations that followed. Now, the point about the RSS, what I want to say is that it is an organization that exists. Everybody knows the RSS exists, except at the same time, it doesn't have a bank account. It's not registered as a charitable trust. It does not file any tax returns, right? It doesn't have a specific address, right? So it's an organization that everybody knows exists. Its manifestations come through the existence of certain shakhas or training camps that happen in all parts of India, especially in urban India. But at the same time, there's no corporeal entity that can be tracked down as the RSS. Which then brings us to the question, so if there is such a body which develops volunteers, which is, its translation is, when I say RSS, it's the national, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, its translation, National Volunteers Corps. So where do these volunteers go? It's a systematic training program for volunteers. It's an ideological core unit that produces an army of volunteers. So the question in a certain sense is, how does the RSS work? The RSS works through what's called the Sangh Parivar. The Sangh Parivar or the Sangh family, Sangh taken from RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, Parivar family. The Sangh family is a plethora of organizations that have attributed to themselves different roles within this political movement, which is called Hindutva or right-wing Hindu nationalism, which has as its goal Hindu Rashtra or Hindu nationhood. Amongst the organizations is the Parliamentary Front, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the Indian People's Party, BJP. Amongst the organizations involved is the VHP, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, which is the World Hindu Council, which is its kind of militant cultural wing, political wing. Amongst the organizations is the Bajrang Dal, which is the kind of militant on-the-street toughies, the goons, the goon squad. Plethora of other organizations like ABVP, the Akhil Bharatiya Vidyarthi Parishad, which is a student wing in India. And amongst the very critical organizations, but one that is least known, is the entire Seva Vibhag, or the service wing of the RSS. In the late 80s especially, as the RSS revival began, middle 80s to late 80s, you can go back and look at the texts written by the current Sarsangh Chalak, or the supreme leader of the RSS, the current supreme leader of the RSS, who used to be one of the secretaries for the RSS way back in the 80s, wrote a series of texts in which it's very clear that part of the strategy for expansion of the RSS was its service wing. And the way it set up its service wing was through not a single organization, but through a few flagship organizations and then a plethora of small little organizations spread across the country. You would have organizations which by name have no clear resemblance, would not announce itself as an RSS organization. As a matter of fact, no organization announces itself as an RSS organization. It's just it's a spread technology which is in a certain sense very similar to some of the ways in which fascist organizations have spread in the past. So the Seva Vibhag of the RSS, flagship organizations among them being the Seva Bharati, which has its which has a unit available in nearly every Indian state, the Vanvasi Kalyan Ashram, so whole bunch of smaller flagship organizations, and then a plethora of small organizations are spread across the country. Now every country has its right wing, you know. Every country, in a certain sense, ends up with a right wing, which it deserves in terms of how much people fight back to stop the right wing. In India, I would say that on the whole, except for the last decade or more, Indian centrist and progressive forces have done an excellent job in terms of holding it back. But as I said, every country has its right wing. You know, you can go all the way from India to Bangladesh, where the Jamaat has been recently resurgent. You can go to Israel and the rabid Zionist lobby that has emerged there over the last several decades. You can go to Iran with the Shiite fundamentalists that that have taken control of the state for the last several decades. You can go to Sri Lanka and you'll find right-wing Sinhala nationalism, which then bred right-wing Tamil nationalism. I mean, a whole bunch of things has happened all across the world. But the important question for me is, how does this kind of right-wing nationalism get exported? Now let me talk to you about the Hindutva, or the RSS, the Sangh Parivar's organizational structure in the United States. They have literally an equivalent for every organization back at home here. There is the Hindu Swayamsevak Sangh, the HSS, which is the equivalent for the RSS. There's the VHP of America, the Vishnu Hindu Parishad of America, which is the equivalent for the VHP in India. They have the Bajrang Dal, which is the they're the equivalent for the Bajrang Dal outside is the Hindu Unity Group. There is the Hindu Student Council spread across many different university campuses across the United States, which is the student wing of the equivalent to the ABVP in India. And In the case of the service wing, the equivalent of Seva Bharati and many other plethora of organizations, there have been a few organizations created outside of India. And the India Development and Relief Fund in the United States is one of those. And Seva International in England is the other, which are chief amongst us. In looking at the kind of funding, in looking at the kind of money movements that have happened, we are convinced that we probably know a small fraction of the total money that moves. But it's important to put that information of whatever little that we know out there. To speak about money is to speak about two things. One is the specific mechanisms by which this moves, and the other is to speak about why people participate in this politics, something that Sriram highlighted. I can go into great amount of detail in terms of how the money moves, because a report, the Foreign Exchange of Hate, documents that money trail very, very effectively. The Foreign Exchange of Hate was a report published by Sabrang Communications and South Asia Citizens Watch. And the campaign to stop funding hate based an entire campaign on that, verified all the details and based an entire campaign on that. What is really important about the Foreign Exchange of Hate report is that it does something very interesting. It set itself a standard. One of the standard things that happens when you challenge right-wing groups is that they start name-calling. They say, oh, you're a communist, you're this, you're that. It's a whole bunch of name-calling and a whole bunch of trying to delegitimize the sources from where the information came. So the Foreign Exchange of Hate report does something very interesting. It put itself a standard that 70% of the documents used to construct the report, to build the evidence, has to be documents from within the Sangh Parivar, from IDRF, from the RSS, from the HSS, from the VHP. It has to be documents that they created and they distributed. That standard is what has saved that report. Because going by that, for instance, the entire tabulation of the money, the Foreign Exchange of Hate report looks at the period between 1995-96 to 2000-2001. It examines IDRF's money, the money that it sent back to India during this seven-year period, and during the six-year period. And what it does is collect all of the financial data, every single penny. Information about every single penny is collected from IDRF annual reports, which they put up on their own websites, and from tax returns of the IDRF. There is not a single bit of information about the money from any other source. So IDRF has two choices. Either to say that the annual reports it put out were false, or to accept the findings, or to find inconsistencies with it in terms of maybe there are some mistakes in terms of how it was calculated, what was done, etc., etc. But the facts speak for themselves. This is a single important reason. And let me just give you a few highlights. Okay. We went back, or when we look at the Foreign Exchange of Hate report, you'll see that one of the first documents they look at is the original filing for tax exemption. Okay. That is, IDRF filed for tax exemption of 501c3 status in 1989. And that document, which it submitted to the U.S. government, the IRS, is one of the original source documents, in which they list a total of 9 sample organizations. The IRS has a question. They're saying, give us a sample of organizations that you would fund. And they list a total of 9 sample organizations that they claim they will fund. Every one of those 9 organizations are RSS organizations. Then you come to the funding. When you look at 1995-96 to 2000-2001, we find that under an extremely liberal schema, more than 80% of the funds went to RSS organizations. Under such circumstances, how do you challenge a report? What do you have to say about a report that takes data from your own sources and produces all this? Because our claim, or the campaign to stop funding hate, when it picked up the Foreign Exchange of Hate report and went forward with it, our position wasn't that the Hindu right wing, the Sangh Parivar, does not have a right to collect money in the United States. They absolutely have a right to collect as much money as they want in the United States. Except they should stand up and say that they are part of the RSS and then collect the money. The original tax exemption filing, in which these 9 organizations, all of which are RSS, claims simultaneously that IDRF is a secular, non-sectarian organization. That is the fundamental objection. Put your identity out and collect what you need to collect. Okay? Then it's an open, straight political battle, and it's fair game. But why the subterfuge? As a matter of fact, I mean, to get to the subterfuge, maybe I should take a very specific example. The IDRF and various of its fronts did try to produce various counter reports to the Foreign Exchange of Hate report. But I could have gone into the details of the counter report, because all it does is obfuscate the material and doesn't take on any of our claims. For instance, it doesn't go into the 9 organizations. It doesn't go into more than 80% of the funds, etc., etc. It doesn't go into any of that, right? But then, actually, instead of going into those reports, a summary of those reports emerged through a petition that was crafted a few days ago on Yuma, for, I presume, in response to this talk. And the petition has a series of facts, which they claim is the basis for why they claim that they want people's support. There are 11. The petition goes on. The petition created at UMass Lowell claims that IDRF is a wonderful organization because it does really good work, and it quotes 11 organizations. It lists 11 organizations as the kind of NGOs that it funds. Again, clearly trying to distance any of those 11 organizations from the RSS. I picked up that petition and did a simple analysis, picked up all the data around it and did a simple analysis. And here are the simple facts. Those 11 organizations, if you total up the total amount of money in the 6-year period of our report, if you look at the total amount of money, it amounts to $180,000, that's all, out of a total of $4.6 million that was distributed. In other words, these 11 organizations that are quoted in this petition represent less than 4% of the money that IDRF sent abroad. And yet, it is the 11 organizations that they choose to highlight in this petition. What about all the rest of it? If you take one single organization, the flagship organization, Seva Bharati, that has received excess of $250,000, that is just Seva Bharati Madhya Kshetra, Middle Bharat, right? right? That is, one flagship organization, one sector organization, has received $250,000, which is a lot more than what these 11 organizations all put together have received, and yet they choose to highlight these 11 organizations and leave that one out. You take the next one, the Vanvasi Kalyan Ashram. You take Bharat Vikas Pratishthan. You take a whole series of flagship organizations, and they account for a vast majority of the funds that were sent abroad, sent from here to India, and yet it is 11 of the most minusculely funded organizations that are picked up and highlighted. In these 11 organizations, let me take two of them. Okay. One of them claims to be an organization that, the one of them, Sikruti, is an organization that received up to around 90,000. That is, two of the RSS organizations in this list of 11 account for more than 50% of even within this 11. Okay. And it was for the Orissa cyclone. Okay. Now, I want to use that moment of looking at something like relief for a cyclone to go into the politics of such relief work. Can deny the goodness of relief? Who? The goodness of relief can be denied only when you look at the products of that relief. Odisha was one place where a lot of money went. Gujarat earthquake, another place where a lot of money went. Look at the history, or look at the record of Hindutva and the kind of polarization of society that's been done in Odisha and Gujarat post these waves of money going in. And that should speak a lot. Relief does not come simply as the helping hand to somebody who's stricken. Relief in this case comes with propaganda, with ideology, with a lot of hate politics. And that is the fundamental problem with this kind of relief. That is the fundamental problem with thinking about good work in some kind of an isolated structure. The U.S. Army may tomorrow designate a whole bunch of people to go after the U.S. Army has whipped across Iraq and do relief work. That does not make the U.S. Army any better. That does not make the U.S. state any better when it can wreak such havoc or produce such hate and then say we are doing relief. The point simply is that we have to look at the politics of relief and development in a very concrete sense. When money goes from here, let me actually read a passage out to you. And it's, you know, when this goes far beyond relief. A lot of the money, of course, that went did not go simply for relief in these particular cases of Orissa cyclone or the Gujarat earthquake. Let me read you a small segment. IDRF claims it has observers or people who go in and do audits of the work that it does. Let me read you a small description from an IDRF report back by one Mr. Vishnu Kumar, who is reporting back on Seva Bharati activities in Madhya Kshetra, the place where I said $250,000 went straight off. Behind the behind the success of Hindu Sangam is the devotion and hard work of 350 Ekal Vidyalayas and 250 whole-time workers of Seva Bharati. They travelled continuously to practically every village for 3 months and visited about 3,25,000 families and established a place of worship by putting a photo of Bajrang Bali, Sri Hanuman, that is, Bajrang Bali is another name for Hanuman. They also taught them how to worship and also made them learn and sing bhajans. In the Yajna of awakening, another 3,500 workers also participated for 1 week and helped garlanding 28 lakhs tribals with lockets of Hanumanji. Similarly, Bhagwa or the saffron flags were also hoisted on practically each and every tribal house. All these activities were performed with the expressed desire and willingness of the head of the household. Last year, during the Ganesh Festival, about 1,500 Ganesh statues were installed in a number of villages. And on the festival of Ganesh, Chaturthi, sessions were organized, which large number of tribals participated in. And it goes on and on. Now, how would you like that as a description of development? That is religious work. Why is it development? Why is it relief? You collect money in the name of relief and development, claiming to be a secular organization, and what you are doing is going into tribal Adivasi areas and working to convert them into mainstream Hinduism. How does that function as development? I just want to know. The report backs, they claim they have report backs, and it's fascinating to read the report backs because it's all about the inculcation of Hindu values. Occasionally there's a mention of some schools being built, but when you look at the school curriculum, then it goes even crazier. The Ekal Vidyalaya, the one teacher school. I have a whole record of around 70 Ekal Vidyalayas and the curriculums that they follow and the written testimonies of village people in the village from Andhra Pradesh. That's fascinating. When you look at it, you cannot call it straightforward education. It's minor levels of what I would call secular education with huge doses of bhajans and building temples as voluntary activity, etc., etc. I would seriously like to know how any of us can classify that as development work. Having, you know, looked at this in some detail now, I actually want to go into some details. Why is it this happens? Why is it that people living here in the United States, middle class professionals in large part, take on such a task? Why is it? What is it about the nature of life here that produces the situation wherein you take on the task of spreading hate abroad? How can you live with the secular protection that you enjoy here and attempt to create a society somewhere else that is bereft of such protection? What is it about the immorality of that politics, and what is it that makes it acceptable? And there are interesting reasons for it. It's a set of reasons that we need to be sensitive to at some level. America is a polarized society also. It's a society in which racism runs rampant. It's a society where the substructure is one of racism. And one of the constant experiences of immigrant groups, especially third world immigrant groups when they come here, is a series of marginalizations that happen to them in the public domain. And one of the reactions to such marginalization, such kind of undertone of constant racism that marginalizes them again and again, is a situation wherein they finally end up withdrawing into the private, and the attempt to preserve a private to give themselves a sense of self, a sense of meaning, so that they can meaningfully continue life here, because you cannot leave the dollar and go back. Right? So there is this great desire to produce a sense of self and to hold it together. And this is something that comes most clearly, it happens to middle-aged men in a large part, because, I mean, I'm saying this because I also I'm part of a collective that runs a youth training camp for the last 8 years in New York for second-generation South Asian Americans. And one of the things that I notice is that every year we train around anywhere between 30 to 50 people. Every year, if there are 30 in the in the workshop, 26 or 27 of them are women. They are the ones who take the brunt of this kind of privatized demand to hold together a particular sense of identity. And in that kind of a context, packaged religion comes in really, really handy. And that's what Hindutva is here. It's packaged religion. You have your organizations that you can participate in. You can give your guilt money away to on the claim that it's doing both keeping that religious value alive back at home and doing relief simultaneously, your development simultaneously, right? So it's a particular form of packaged religion that works. And American culture, or American, I mean, let's say the structure of social public life in America, has been one that for other reasons has been fundamentally incapable of challenging such regressive actions in American public life. That's because of the way multiculturalism itself is constructed. I mean, I can think of a couple of examples. I mean, one of the things that happened, for instance, was way back in the early 90s, there was an exhibition called Hamsa Bayodhya, which was an exhibition of multiple interpretations or multiple renditions of the Ramayana that was sent around by this organization called Sehmat in India. It had some very crazy interpretations of the Ramayana, including one that made a claim from Thailand that Rama and Sita were not a couple in the husband-wife sense of the word, but a brother-sister, siblings. And various other ones. There were some stories about Rama's ill-treatment of Bali Raja, etc. So there were various tales like that. So I was in Princeton at that point, and I brought that exhibition onto Princeton campus. A whole bunch of Hindutvavadis responded. They raised protests. But guess who came to their rescue? A whole bunch of white administrators. Came running, wringing their hands, saying, "Oh my God, minority is being ill-treated." Without realizing this underlying structure of politics. Right? And this is the problem with multiculturalism. The problem with multiculturalism is that after a radical moment in the 60s, it became a particular way of completely ahistorically treating cultures and extracting out of a whole fabric, a cultural fabric, something that's positive. It becomes food. It becomes this. You know, one of my greatest examples for this is, you know, as I said, I organized with the Taxi Workers Alliance in New York City. And there was this deli, a small eatery on 9th Avenue, which was, how much time do I have? 5 minutes.
Well, I think it's 3 to 5.
But. Okay. No, I'll finish from 3 to 5. So, the Eat Again Delhi was a small little Punjabi eatery run by a set of Indian sardars who used to be taxi drivers, Andy Singh and Mohinder Singh. Now, one fine morning, a column showed up in New York Times in the dining out section under the under 25 column, which said, "Eat Again Delhi, eat what cabbies eat." And it celebrated makki di roti and sarson di saag as delicacies. I didn't even see the column. But that weekend, a friend of mine called me and said, "Arey, did you see this column?" And I said, no, I didn't see it. So they said, "Why don't you come?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, I know the guys at the deli, let's go." When we got there, there was a line that went 3 times around the block. And when we tried to squeeze our way into the deli, there were white people hanging off the counter, trying to get their share of makki di roti and sarson di saag. Okay? Now, the reason why the story is interesting is not because, of course, people should go and eat sarson di saag and makki di roti as much as they can get. I think it's good food. But the very same community of people, which is Chelsea, kind of a upper middle class neighborhood in New York, the very same community of people had been for the past 1 year running a campaign against the deli trying to get rid of it. And failing to get rid of the deli, get rid of the taxi stand on the grounds that these were dirty people. That these Punjabis who showed up there were loud and dirty. Okay? Now, for me, that's the interesting question. What is it that allows somebody to extract that thing called makki di roti and make it a delectable thing and simultaneously reject the lives of hardworking people who spend 12 bloody hours behind the wheel of a taxi cab? What is it? And the answer to it is multiculturalism. It's a particular form of extracting what they want. It's a particular form of relating to culture as a commodity and extracting it and commodifying it and producing it. Dehistoricized completely. It is what Zizek calls the inverted racism of late capitalism. It is these two trends, the trend of constructing a secure private space wherein your values, your religion, your this thing is held together in this vehement fashion, which can then be presented as a positive, and the failure of multiculturalism in the post-70s phase, especially as it was destroyed during the Reagan era, that come together to produce a unique kind of lack of criticality in how we examine race politics, and especially this kind of relief work and development work. And it is this that we need to guard against. I've had it with going to meeting after meeting wherein, you know, as a community of people, for instance, in Lowell, you have Indians, you have white people, black people, brown people, purple people, whatever types.
We have to find a common language of criticality around questions of violence, sectarianism, hate, etc. And we can't simply say, be relativist about it, saying, oh, you know, that's a wonderful group. They wear nice bindis. Sorry. We don't have that luxury. It is precisely the same kind of luxury that allows us ourselves to distance ourselves from the people of Iraq today. We have to find a way of getting to this. And specifically to a whole bunch of, to all my Indian friends here, I'll say, you know, really, really examine this process. I've given many talks in which again and again a lot of Indian students come and tell me, see, I'm not part of the Sangh Parivar, but you know, I don't like what you do. You end up bashing India. No, I'm saying no, this is what we are is what we have to be proud of, that we have a critical tradition that has stood up to the test for centuries, and we must think about this as a continuation of that critical tradition which produces a certain kind of cosmopolitanism that is rare in the world. It is that which we must reach out for. If you, in the short term, if you take this as India bashing, as giving India a bad name, in 10 years, in 15 years, 20 years, you won't have an India to speak about with any degree of pride. I'm sorry. Who delivered the India once again in this election? The cities, the middle class overwhelmingly voted for the Hindu right wing. It is the poor people of India who voted against them this time. Fundamentally, if you look at how the coalition, the NDA coalition was broken, you'll see the vote coming from the poorer segments of population. And I think we must understand that, and we must give ourselves that critical tradition. Stand on the shoulders of those people, okay, and work our way through this. When we talk so openly, there's nothing better than an open discourse about both the good things about one society and the bad things about one society. That is true multiculturalism in a certain sense. When Madonna wears a bindi and a whole bunch of Hindutva groups carried out a campaign against that, I too had a problem with her wearing a bindi, but not because it was cultural appropriation, but because she doesn't stand shoulder to shoulder with us when we face racist attacks. That is solidarity, and if we are building structures of solidarity, we cannot build it without recognizing the nature of the problems involved. Thank you.